John chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Queen Victoria would often stroll the streets of the cities of Scotland incognito. She would leave her royal robes on hangers and slip away from her palace and walk the cobblestone streets dressed in the tattered garments of a peasant. Once the queen slipped out the side gate, accompanied by only her servant. As they were trying to cross the street, they got in the way of a shepherd boy who was leading his flocks to the market. The boy, not knowing, she shouted out at her. She said, "Hey, keep out of the way, you stupid old lady." Well, quickly the servant approached the boy and informed them that he had just chewed out the Queen of Scotland. The boy didn't believe it. He snarled back, "Well, if that's the queen, why doesn't she start dressing like a queen?" Well, that's exactly what we could have said of King Jesus. For he too failed to dress the part. Who would have thunk it? The Almighty God left his royal residence, the halls of heaven, dressed in the likeness of a mortal man. The eternal Spirit became flesh and bone. You know, it's easy for me to imagine God in the form of a thunderbolt, slicing a stormy sky with a violent zap, demanding the world's attention. Or maybe like a celestial fireball spinning in the night sky, filling the heavens with glory and the earth with fear. Or perhaps a mysterious moonbeam, some eerie light piercing the dark, arousing our curiosity. We all can conceptualize God coming to earth in some sizzling, extravagant, eye-catching, awe-inspiring demonstration of nature. But God coming in swaddling clothes? Who would have thunk it? God became a man. He came to earth incognito. He walked our streets dressed as one of us. In John chapter 1, verse 14, our text this morning, the apostle speaks of Jesus as the Word, or in the original language, the Logos. The word Logos was a technical term used by the Greek philosophers to define ultimate truth. The Greeks noticed the order and the symmetry within nature, and they concluded that there had to be a master plan, a kind of logic behind the natural universe, a logos behind the cosmos, a reason behind reality. The Greeks had the same philosophy as the frustrated fellow who said, "Life must go on, I just forgot why." They concluded there had to be a purpose. They just had no idea what it was. The Greeks assumed that this logos was some impersonal force. The why was a what. But John surprises his readers. For he says the why is not a what, it is a who. The logos is a person. John says that Jesus is the Word. Please understand, Jesus is not only the reason for the season, He's the reason behind all of life. Every season, there is no real meaning or purpose apart from Him. And John makes an even more astonishing statement. This surely baffled the philosophers. Verse 14, the Word, the Logos, became flesh. The Logos became a man. The unified theory, as the philosophers might call it, the ultimate end-all, the rationale behind all reality, the logic behind our living, the answer to every question, was born and was laid in a manger. He came as a little baby. Imagine this. The Logos played with Legos. Christians use a Latin expression to describe what happened, incarne, which means in the flesh. Jesus was God incarnate, or God in human skin. The Word became flesh, John says, and dwelt among us. In Jesus, God joined the human family. He became fully human, and in doing so, subjected Himself to the full range of human emotions and experiences. He walked our streets. He ate our food. He wore our clothes. He learned our customs. He lived life in the trenches. Jesus became a human to the same degree that you and I are humans. Author Max Lucado, he describes in practical terms what this meant. He says, God was given eyebrows, elbows, two kidneys, and a spleen. He stretched against the walls and floated in the amniotic fluids of his mother. God came near. Mary changed his diapers. The Almighty learned to walk. Children played in the street with him. Jesus may have had pimples. He may have been tone deaf. Perhaps a girl down the street had a crush on him. It could be that his knees were bony. He felt weak. He grew weary. He was tempted. He got colds, burped, and had body odor. He snored, blew his nose, and hit his thumb with his hammer. His feelings got hurt. His feet got tired. His head ached. For 33 years, he would feel everything that you and I have ever felt. And by the look on your face this morning, I'm not sure you agree. I know the feeling. It sounds a little irreverent to say, God blew his nose. We don't often picture our Lord Jesus needing to go to the bathroom, or his feet swelling, or his nose bleeding, or his body sweating, or him getting hungry and thirsty. Our theology is reluctant to account for the fact that the Son of God soiled his diapers. And yet that is exactly the Jesus that the New Testament portrays. Jesus was totally divine, but equally so, he was totally human. If you still doubt, let me reel off a few scriptures you can chew on later. In John chapter 4, verse 6, Jesus got tired. In Matthew 4, verse 2, Jesus was hungry. John 19, verse 28, he grew thirsty. Matthew 8, verse 24, he slept. Hebrews 2, verse 8, he was tempted. Mark 3, verse 5, he got angry. Luke 22, verse 44, he perspired. In John 11, verse 35, Jesus even wept. There were those in the first century who were uncomfortable with this concept of a truly human Jesus. They twisted theology because they couldn't handle his humanity. Some people taught that Jesus didn't really have a human body, that his body was an illusion, that he was actually a phantom or a ghost or an apparition. And they told fanciful tales of Jesus walking on the beach but leaving no footprints in the sand. Others said that the divine Christ came upon the human Jesus at his baptism and then departed before his crucifixion. But the two were not the same. A heretic by the name of Nestorius once said, "I could not call a baby 2 or 3 months old God." Much of the New Testament was written to confront and to correct these errors. It's interesting, this man John, who wrote the Gospel of John, he actually lived for the 3.5 years that Jesus was on the earth. He lived with Jesus during that time. And in his first letter, John makes this comment. He says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning the word or logos of life." John wanted everyone to know that he and his friends had touched Jesus. He had grabbed Jesus' arm to lead him through the crowd pressing against him. Like any group of guys, I'm sure the disciples and Jesus sort of wrestled at times in front of the campfire. How can guys get together and not do that? The disciples saw smoke come out of Jesus' mouth on a cold day. They felt the heat rise from his body after a long walk. When Jesus held out his hand to rescue John from danger, his grip was real. Don't tell John that Jesus' body was an illusion. John had touched Jesus, and Jesus had touched John. Jesus was no phantom. John testifies that the Logos was a man. Peter also addresses this issue in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. He tells us that Jesus was put to death in the flesh. In other words, the divine Christ didn't somehow split from the human Jesus. It was God incarnate who literally died on a Roman cross. Messiah's divinity and humanity were two characteristics of one person, not two different people. It's mind-boggling to think it. But the same God who created the wood from which the crossbeams were carved, and the metal from which the nails were forged, and the men who hammered in those nails, that same God literally died on the cross. In 1 John chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, John draws this conclusion. He says, "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God." It's interesting that the disciples in the early church believed so strongly in the humanity of Jesus that they made it the litmus test for orthodoxy in the church. To them, it was as important to believe that Christ was man as it was to believe that he was God. The doctrine of the dual nature of Jesus was hammered out once and for all at the Council of Chalcedon in 451 AD. There in the city of Chalcedon, a group of church leaders and Bible scholars gathered together to hammer out a declaration on the nature of Christ. They issued a doctrinal statement which has never been improved upon. It goes like this: "Following the Holy Fathers, we confess with one voice that the one and only Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, is perfect in Godhead and perfect in manhood, truly God and truly man. He is of one substance with the Father as God. He is also of one substance with us as man. He is like us in all things except sin." I'm sure we all would agree with that statement of faith. We'd probably sign it. Hopefully, we would fight for it. But for most of us, we're still a lot more comfortable with the deity of Jesus than we are with his humanity. There's something about keeping him divine that keeps him distant. Royalty seems pretty far removed from our reality. And yet, the more human we see Jesus, the more relevant he becomes to our struggles and to our challenges. When it dawns on us that Jesus walked in our shoes and shared our human predicament, we can no longer dismiss his promises, nor can we ignore his commands. The man who challenges us to love him more than friends and family and to follow him regardless is the exact same man who kissed his mom goodbye in the doorway of a carpenter's shop and left home to do God's will. The man who told us to love our enemies is the same man who hung on that cross in excruciating pain and prayed for his murderer's forgiveness. The man who encourages us to lay up treasure in heaven and not on earth is the same man who died wearing all that he owned and was buried in a borrowed tomb. The man who instructs us to deny ourselves and serve others is the same man who laid aside the comforts of heaven to be born in a smelly stable. You see, the humanity of Jesus strips me of my excuses. It's impossible for me to take refuge in the assumption, "Oh, God just doesn't understand what I'm going through," or "That's easy for him to say." You can't say that when you realize that Jesus was as human as you are and as I am. You know, if all you're after this morning in a God is a little icon you can set on your mantle, the mantle of your life, a God to whom you can pay occasional homage, a God that you can sort of show off to your friends to prove how religious you are, if that's all you're interested in a God, you don't want God incarnate. You want a way off, somewhere, out there kind of God. You need a God that you can keep at a distance, that can be worshipped perhaps on Sundays in the midst of the smell of incense and stained glass, yet removed from everyday life. You see, the God-man is too real. He's too close to home. He's too relevant. He is an invader that you cannot keep out of the privacy of real life. For Jesus has been where you're at, and He's felt what you feel, and He is closer than you think. As one author writes, let Christ be as human as He intended to be. Let Him into the mire and muck of our world, for only if we let Him in can He pull us out. To those who understand Christ's humanity as well as His deity, the incarnate invader becomes a comfort and a hope. What is an encroachment to some folks becomes an encouragement to others. The incarnation of Jesus will scare you if you want to live your life on your own. But if you're leaning on Him, it becomes your greatest solace. When I realize that Jesus has been where I'm at, that He feels what I feel, then I can trust Him with my hurts and my heart and my insecurities and my weaknesses and my frailties. He's faced them all before. He's already conquered my struggles once. He can do it again. He can heal because He once was hurt. He can be a friend because He knows what it's like to need one. He can untangle temptation because He's overcome it in His own life. Theologian Helmut Thickle once wrote this: man is told of a loving Father above the starry skies. He thinks of Him up there in some monumental headquarters, while He sits in a foxhole somewhere on this isolated front, somewhere on this trash heap, working at a stupid job that gives Him misery. What does He get out of it when He's told there is a supreme intelligence that conceived the creation of the world, devised the laws of cause and effect, and maneuvered the planets into their orbits? All He can say to that is, well, you don't say, and then go on reading the newspaper or turn on the television. For that certainly is not a message by which He can live. But if someone says, there is someone who knows you, who grieves when you go your own way, and it cost Him something to be the star to which you can look, the staff by which you can walk, the spring from which you can drink. When a man realizes this is true, really true, that someone is interested in him and shares his lot, then this can suddenly revolutionize his life. The incarnation means that God has become a man and that I am no longer in darkness. In the year 1959, a northern journalist by the name of John Griffin decided to discover what it was like to be a black man living in the South. At first he thought that he would just tour the region as an observer, but he knew that that would limit his perspective. Instead, he decided to change his skin color to actually make himself black. Griffin took oral medications and he used sun lamp treatments, and he dyed the pigment of his skin with various types of stains. And then he traveled across the South and tasted firsthand the horrors of racial prejudice and the plight of African Americans at the time. John Griffin published his findings in a book entitled Black Like Me. Well, Jesus became a man like me. He put on my skin. He dressed as one of us so that He could understand firsthand our plight and our oppression. When you observe another person's plight from a distance, you might feel sympathy. But sympathy is not empathy. True empathy is participation in someone else's feelings. Empathy has been defined as your pain in my heart. To really feel what another person feels, you have to get close. You have to get personally involved. It was not enough for Jesus to observe the human dilemma from His lofty perch in heaven. We're told in our text, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This word, dwelt, means literally to pitch a tent. Jesus pitched His tent among us. I love how Eugene Peterson paraphrases verse 14. He says, the Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. God came to the hood. The sovereign God got down on our level. He joined our predicament. He shares our plight so that He can lead us out. He shoulders our sufferings. God stepped out of heaven and he slipped into your shoes. He understands us in a new way. Since the incarnation, God now cries and laughs with us, not just at us. God weeps when we weep. He smiles when we smile. He bleeds when we bleed. Years ago, my son Nick, he played in a big soccer game. His undefeated team was playing the league's other undefeated team. And for that one game, Nick lined up at the goalie position, which meant that the whole season was riding on his shoulders. I mean, the pressure was on. I literally played that game alongside my son. I was on the sidelines, but every time he squatted, I squatted. Every time he lunged, I lunged. He moved left, I moved left. On and on it went the whole game. By the time it was over, I was exhausted. I've been in these kind of competitive situations myself, and I could feel what Nick was feeling. And this is how Jesus reacts when he sees me today under pressure. He's felt the same pressure. He doesn't just look at my life in some unanimated condition. He feels what I feel. He lunges when I lunge. He squats when I squat. He knows exactly what I'm going through. And he's right there mimicking my movements. He's bending and he's moving as I work through my dilemma. Hebrews 2 expresses this truth. It says, in all things, Jesus had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. This Greek word that's translated aid, it literally means to run to the cry of a child. Did you know that when Jesus sees you hurt, he races to your side? For he has known the same pain. He feels what you feel. For Jesus to shoulder our burdens, it was first required that he share them. Hey, how can someone help me through a busy day who's never had one himself? How can someone who's never felt the stressful circumstance I'm enduring help me cope? How can someone who's never lost a loved one comfort me in my grief? Understand, Jesus' marching orders don't come from some heavenly bureaucrat who's never been in the trenches, but from a battle-scarred general. Jesus is a veteran who's experienced the enemy's fire, and he knows well the keys to victory. There is an Italian movie that opens with a helicopter sort of ferrying a giant concrete statue of Jesus to the city of Rome. The helicopter passes over the landscape as this giant Jesus, concrete Jesus, with his arms stretched out, hangs from a sleeve underneath the helicopter. At one point, a farmer looks up and he spots this Jesus coming across the field, and he jumps off of his tractor and he runs to the edge of his field shouting, "It's Jesus! It's Jesus!" As the helicopter moves closer to Rome, it passes over a swimming pool full of bikini-clad girls. The copter pilot sort of swoops lower. This airborne concrete statue of Jesus just sort of hangs there above it all, expressionless, emotionless, unmoved. You see, there are people today who tragically envision the real Jesus as some concrete Jesus. He's huge and he's heavy. He seems to lack empathy. He just sort of hovers over the world, expressionless, emotionless. Jesus appears to be on the outside looking in. He seems removed and judgmental and distant. What does this God in heaven know about the trials that I face? Hey, forever Christmas dispels those notions. For Christmas teaches us that God is no concrete Christ, that Jesus became one of us, that he feels, that he cares, and that he shares your feelings and your emotions. John 1 verse 17 and 18 tell us, "For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." Jesus' humanity revealed to man a side of God that had previously been hidden from view. In the Old Testament, people saw God at a distance. They had to squint over a huge gulf called the law and peer through a thick cloud called sin. Therefore, the view was blurred. They saw God's character embodied in a standard of behavior. But due to their sin, the standard was all that they saw. They never saw past God's impeccable purity. They concluded that God must be some starch judge, that he might be willing to forgive, but he certainly didn't want their fellowship. He was more concerned with rules than relationship. You see, in the Old Testament, man could see that God was immense. But from that, he concluded that he was cold and impersonal. But that was not the God that Jesus revealed. In Christ, the God whose glory fills the universe was the same man who let the little children play in his lap. In the Old Testament, the Hebrews could see that God was powerful. But they assumed that he exercised his power in cruel and tyrannical ways. Isn't that how other men exercise such power? Again, that was certainly not the God that was revealed in Jesus. For the hands that hung the heavens also healed the sick and fed the multitude and washed his disciples' feet. The Jews also thought that God was too perfect to approach. They thought that because Jesus was sinless, he would want to condemn those who weren't. But that was not the God that Jesus revealed to us. When the woman who was taken in adultery was thrown at Jesus' feet, instead of issuing her sentence, he gave her a new start. Jesus allowed us to see God up close and personal. He was different than we thought. We got a bird's eye view of deity, unobstructed by sin and legalism, in the person of Jesus. In Jesus, we saw God in a fresh new light. In Jesus, we see the heart of God. And what we see is a God of grace and truth. You see, God is not content to stay separated from sinners. God is reaching. He is reaching across the aisle. He is stretching over the canyon. He is willing to forgive, and he wants our fellowship in Jesus. God is reaching. Jesus reveals a God who cares not just about holiness, but about humans. It's been said Jesus was love wrapped in skin. God would never allow his law to thwart his love. And thus he's made a way to satisfy both. Jesus was full of grace and truth. You see, the incarnation proves forever that God is a touchable God. That he wants to touch us. And he's made a way for us to touch him. In Jesus, God is never out of reach. As a matter of fact, look at both poles of Messiah's life, the crib and the cross. How low can love stoop but a crib? How far can love stretch but a cross? Look at either end of Jesus' life and you find him stooping and stretching, reaching out to touch us. You know, we as humans need the stimulus of touch. Pediatricians report that babies who are not cuddled and cradled in loving arms don't grow healthy and psychologically whole. Babies need a mother's touch. And likewise, we need to feel the touch of God. We have that desire. We have that need deep down inside. The storm grew so intense that when the little girl's quivering voice shouted to her mother, "Mommy, I'm scared," it moved the mother's heart and she raced into the room. And mother sort of summed up the situation and knew that her little girl needed to brave the storm. And so she said, "Honey, don't worry. God will be with you." And as the mother was leaving to the other room, the little girl shouted back, "Okay, Mommy. But you stay here with God. I'm going to sleep with Daddy." You know, sometimes we just need to be touched, don't we? We need a God we can touch. And Jesus is the touchable God. Remember how often Jesus touched or was touched by someone? Matthew 14 tells us, they came to the land of Gennesaret, and when the men of that place recognized him, they sent out into all that surrounding region, brought to him all who were sick, and begged him that they might only touch the hem of his garment. And as many as touched were made perfectly well. A woman who had been hemorrhaging for years touched the hem of Jesus' robe, and she was healed. Jesus touched the eyes of a blind man, and his eyes could see. Jesus even touched the untouchable. He touched and he healed the lepers. You remember the woman with the seedy reputation who came to Jesus at the house of Simon the Pharisee? She washed Jesus' feet with her hair and her tears. And the Pharisee, he frowned on such a display. Oh my. He looked down his nose at a sinner like this woman. In Luke 7 we read, the Pharisee spoke within himself saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And hey, the Pharisee was right. Jesus did know what kind of woman was touching him. But thank God, Jesus is willing to be touched by that kind of woman and that kind of man. Jesus is willing to be touched by sinners. When Mary laid her infant son in the manger, the soft pink skin of that newborn baby invited those around the crib to reach out and touch him. The whispers and coos of the contented baby invited those around the manger to cuddle him and to hold him. And those invitations, friend, have never ceased. We're still invited to come and to touch Jesus. Today, would you reach out in faith? The invitation's still open. You can come and you can touch the hem of his garment. And in doing so, you'll find peace for a troubled mind. And you'll find healing for a sick body. And you'll find love for an abandoned life. And you'll find strength for a fearful heart. And you'll find hope for an uncertain future. In fact, you'll find whatever you need this morning if you'll reach out and touch Jesus. In retrospect, though the God lying in the manger was not dressed in royal robes, he was dressed appropriately. For flesh, not fabric, was his fitting attire. The Christmas story begins with a babe in the manger. This Christmas, when you look into that manger, I hope you'll be amazed. God is a man.